Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, on location. Today, irrefutable evidence that physical activity cures depression. I'll get into that and explain why that works. Also today, an in-depth original investigative report on 5G, a special original article, The Race Towards Extinction, Climate Change versus 5G Rollout. Richard Gale and myself have been working on this for some time, and attached to this article will be 67 pages of scientific studies from around the world proving our case. So that article is coming at you in just about 10 minutes. We'll also go to your calls today. We have a talkback line and our voice line where you can call in at any time, 24/7, and leave a question or make a statement, 862-800-6805. Again, 862-800-6805. Also today, we'll be hearing from Dr. Tony Bark and Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. So we have a packed schedule. Let's begin. It was back in the mid-1980s that I did one of the 40, now 41, clinical studies. These studies involve a large number of people who are suffering from a particular condition. There's no medicines used, even though they're medically supervised, but it's all about lifestyle and behavior modification. In this case, the people were suffering from acute depression, very severe depression. They had all been average in psychiatric or psychological counseling for 7 years. They were on meds. At the end of 6 months, 94% were able to say that they felt completely well, no longer suffering depression, were off medication. The most important factor in that was to get them to exercise. Once you're depressed, you become apathetic. The things that once gave you joy and happiness seem a cloud in your life. So we got people exercising 3 times a day, an hour in the morning, 20 minutes in the afternoon, and an hour in the evening. As a result of that, now, of course, there was dietary changes, getting off all sugars and refined carbohydrates, eating to what you actually need instead of eating because of your mood, and then also finding a support system, something that gives you joy. And at that time, I felt that laughter was very important, so we actually would have people get into groups, and the groups would go out once a week to a comedy club, and they would just enjoy the comedian and laugh, plus enjoy the socializing. It got them connected again. And then we did other things. We go into Central Park on Sunday mornings, and there'd be folk dancing classes from around the world. So they'd take folk dancing classes. We get them going to museums and going on the little tours so they could really learn in depth about the different objects of art. So by getting them actively engaged, having a good support system, getting them exercise and cleaning up their diet, we had remarkable results. This is today. This is from Massachusetts General Hospital, a major study, and here's what it says. It says genes do not lie when it comes to determining what is good and healthy for the mind and body. And when Massachusetts-based researchers conducted a genetic variation based study of physical activity, they found strong evidence that exercise could help protect its practitioners from depression. Now, there's a distinct difference between physical activity can reduce the effects of depression, and depression causes a decrease in the level of physical activity. And that's what I mentioned. So when you're feeling depressed, you don't want to do much of anything. So that's why, wherever possible with someone who's depressed, get them out just walking. Get them going from one end of the city to the other. The joys of experiencing new neighborhoods and the culture in those neighborhoods. This was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Psychiatry. So that's important, but it's interesting that it's been 30 years since I did that study, and they're just now today validating that. From the University of Tennessee, published in Psychological Bulletin, they finally figured it out. Wow, you mean they needed a study to figure this out? Smiling can really make people happier. Now, we all know that. We know that when we're around people that smile and laugh, it makes us smile and laugh. We feel better. We feel lighter. And I find in my lectures, by using extemporaneous humor, meaning in the moment, you just, whatever comes to your mind, you say it. It's never politically correct, but then again, humor shouldn't be politically correct. You know, imagine the people who would not be allowed on college campuses today. Some of the people that broke through, George Carlin, Don Rinkles, Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor. Now, these were funny dudes, and yet they would not be allowed because they wouldn't be politically correct. Someone in there, one of the snowflakes, would have to immediately call their helicopter parents and say, I feel offended by something someone said. No, you just got to say what comes in your mind, and when people laugh, they learn. We learn far more, and we retain more of what we learn through laughter. Just something that is important. So they had to do a whole study to prove what all of us have known for a long time. And they actually looked at 50 years of data testing whether facial expressions can lead people to feel the emotions related to those expressions. So conventional wisdom tells us that we can feel a little happier if we simply smile, or that we can get ourselves into a more serious mood if we scowl. But we know that. We know how we feel when we were around two intense people. I was, over the weekend, I was writing the report that you're going to hear in a few moments about 5G. And I took a break, and I just wanted to see what was happening as far as the free speech issue on college campuses. And here were some people who were trying to give a speech, and they were being shouted down. And in one case, I posted it. It was really, it was so over the top. A speaker was invited by members of a college to come to a lecture, and he did. And it was rather an innocuous lecture. Nothing serious about the lecture. But one student decided that he didn't want this to happen, so he was up there clanging cans and yelling and screaming through the entire lecture. And he felt that his rights were more important than all the people who had wanted to hear this. This is the new norm. This is happening not so much on public universities, but an awful lot of the private ones. So what is in the interest of the majority of the faculty or guests or students is irrelevant. Get one person out of 5,000 who decides that today they're going to act like an idiot, and suddenly they can impact the other 5,000 people. That's how polarizing our behaviors are becoming, and also our speech. But what it was I was focused on was looking at the expressions on people's faces, the bewilderment, the sense of apathy, the helplessness. What do you do? And you can't say anything because then the person will use what you said as, now you're getting into my space and I feel threatened. And that's exactly what he did. And I'm thinking, wow, I'm going to mention this tomorrow because this ties in with what I'm going to talk about. What happens when we can laugh? I think the collective left has lost its goddamn mind and its manners and its sense of humor. There is no humor in the corporate left. It's unfortunate. And they wonder why people don't want to vote for him. Wow. And just a heads up, by the way, for those young narcissists in Congress today who think that there shouldn't be 5 seconds go by before your great, deep, insightful wisdom on an issue is made public, you're not very bright. You don't have a lot of wisdom. You're extraordinarily narcissistic and self-serving and selfish. And America is watching. So at some point, there's going to be a pushback. That I promise you. And when there is, maybe the rest of just being a normal, happy human being will prevail. Not at this moment, though. In any case, it's just to mention that what you do with your face makes a difference. So if you're always yelling and screaming, if you're always in someone else's face, don't expect that person to feel good about the experience. But smile and laugh and find humor in yourself and other people. Yeah, that lightens everyone's moment and makes that day easier. Separately, this is from the National Institute of Horticulture and Herbal Science in South Korea. Safflower seeds can help prevent kidney damage caused by chemotherapy. This was published in the American Journal of Chinese Medicine. So the researchers investigated whether the extracts from safflower seeds, that's easy to get, inexpensive, can have a positive effect. And the study showed, yes, it does. So think of all the people getting chemotherapy, like cisplatin treatment. Now think of all the damage to people's kidneys from that. Now think if something could help ameliorate that. So something natural and non-toxic can make a difference. From McMaster University up in Ontario, Canada, published in Cell, Host, and Microbe, the gut microbiome, that's just the good bacteria, that's all it means, contributes to age-associated inflammation. What do I mean? You've heard me say many times that the vast majority of all illnesses in the United States are due to inflammatory responses. And it's relatively simple. If you get stressed and you start yelling and screaming, you produce stress hormones like cortisol. Those stress hormones then immediately cascade throughout the entire body, and they create inflammatory cytokines. So now you get angry, that's a negative, but now you get a double negative, you're killing yourself. Because once you start throwing these inflammatory markers around the body, in the brain, the eyes, everywhere, you are prematurely damaging the DNA. How often? 10,000 times a day to every single cell in the body. That's how bad it is. So this is not a light matter. This is one of those important, insightful moments. So the calmer you are, the happier you are, the more joyful you are, the less damage you're going to do, because you're not going to be creating that inflammatory response. But aside from that, we know that inflammation increases with age, and it's a strong risk factor for death in the elderly. But the underlying cause has not always been clear. And now we know that it's the gut bacteria are one of the culprits behind age-associated inflammation and premature death. It's the imbalance in the composition of the gut microbes as you get older, and that can create leaky guts and allows the release of bacteria products that trigger inflammation and impair your immune function. Now, why? Why in an older person does that happen and not a younger person? Well, in point of fact, it's happening in both. But here's the difference. And again, listen carefully to what I'm saying, because this can help a lot of people if you understand it. It's not that having a bad gut as you age in and of itself is causative. It's the fact that you haven't changed unhealthy behaviors because you're aging. I'll give you an example. I worked, when I came to New York, as a ghostwriter. I edited and wrote, because I write very fast, and I was brought on to the Writers Literary Agency, which handled a lot of very famous writers. And the owner of that agency was herself a very famous feminist writer, Sarah Dona. And she would sit at a table, a desk, and she would eat all day long junk food. And then she would go to sleep, just right there, boom. About 5 minutes, hypoglycemia, about 5 minutes after she'd eaten something, she'd be snoring, and she'd sleep for a half hour. Now, she was not a stupid person. To the contrary, she, as an intellect and as a social activist and human rights person, she was the top of her game. But concerning her physical health, she was at the bottom of it. And because she would say, look, I deserve my pleasure. Okay, and her pleasure was, you know, like she liked cream cheese. And then she liked cheesecake. And she'd have it with a cola. Now, I explained to her what was happening in her body, and she didn't care. So the more she did, the more inflammation she created, the more bad bacteria in the gut she produced, because sugar produces that. And then the more unhealthy food you eat, the more unhealthy bacteria you create, and then that creates an unhealthy relationship between the bacteria in your gut and everywhere else in the body, because you're creating massive inflammation. So when you suddenly end up with arthritis, that's also frequently caused by those same inflammatory cytokines, but also your gut bacteria. So the bottom line is that if you're never going to change, and if you feel because you're older now, somehow you deserve your pleasures, and if your pleasure is alcohol, or one of my buddies, it was marijuana, and he did so much marijuana that it created a permanent state of psychosis. In fact, the last 5 years of his life, he lived with his son, who's a wonderful guy, out in Hawaii. And I said, bring him here. I'll work with him. I'll detox him. I've detoxed people off marijuana. Again, separate out his marijuana. Should it be legal? Yes. Should we be using the oils? Yes. Should we be helping people with seizures and autism and lung cancer? Yes. Should we be smoking it? No. Should it be penalized? No. Is it just stupid? Beyond stupid. Do we justify it because, hey man, you know, you don't smoke and go out and kill someone? That's a stupid justification. I cannot tell you how many friends have ended up with delusional psychosis, paranoia, and glucose poisoning. I mean, really screws up the actual brain. And if anyone wants to come in and have a debate on that, I'll be happy to. I wrote several papers on what's actually in there and how much carcinogenicity you get from smoking versus a cigarette. Far more cancer is caused from marijuana smoking to the lungs than cigarettes. It's that bad. But should it be made illegal? No. But I've been there and I've seen in my friends what it did to them. And there's a case where someone was so into their pleasure that they forgot what is the price of that pleasure. There's a price to pay. And then one day, you get the bill. Time to check out. Here's your bill. I've seen it in all the people I've known. Not one was willing to make those changes. So that's what this is saying. I just want you to understand that. So if you get older, you're not dying because you're getting older, per se, and you're not dying the diseases of aging, because there really are none. You're dying because of the senescence that are built into the cell itself. But then everything else you do that's negative speeds it up. So you can have two people, both 70. One looks 95, the other looks 50. Why? It's what they've done to the bacteria and what those bacteria have done in the rest of the body. And all of it's based upon inflammatory issues. And that's why to be on an anti-inflammatory diet, drinking anti-inflammatory juices, laughing is anti-inflammatory. Arguing is pro-inflammatory. So you see, there's almost nothing we do in life that doesn't have a cause and effect. But we get into these moods and we don't think about the consequences. We should. By the way, University of Texas Southwest did a study, and a stunning one-third of people with a cancer diagnosis use some form of complementary alternative medicine, but none of it medical. They'll use meditation or yoga or acupuncture or supplements, but they're still getting the chemotherapy and radiation. They're just doing this because these have all been shown by quality studies to lessen the adverse effects of the mainstream therapies. Well, what would happen if the National Cancer Institute took 100 people that they select, and they cross-match another 100 that they select, one group receives the best orthodox treatment, the other one receives completely alternative treatment, and you follow them. That study's never been done. Boy, I'd like to see that done. That's the latest on health and healing. And by the way, from the University of Mashhad, which is in Iran, avocados are one of the best things you can consume if you have metabolic syndrome, meaning diabetes, high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol. But I would also use cinnamon, garlic, grapes, black cumin, saffron, rutin, R-U-T-I-N. They also are great for metabolic syndrome and diabetes. That's it on health and nutrition. Back in a moment. And we're going to go right back to some of your calls.
Hi, Gary. I listen to your program. My name is Valerie Lashak. I was listening to your program about the talk about the vaccine against the measles, and the man who was speaking mentioned that they could now take a sample of the measles and get the DNA, and they discovered that some of the outbreaks were due to the vaccine DNA measles. And I was wondering if anybody is doing, or I'd like to encourage whoever knows how to do that to check out the measles outbreak now and become definitive about whether it's the problem of the kids not vaccinated or the kids that are vaccinated that are giving everybody the measles. So thank you so much for your program. I appreciate it.
In point of fact, it has been shown repeatedly that the measles vaccine is causing shedding for 2 to 3 weeks afterwards. That means that all mucus coming out of the body, out of the nose and out of the mouth, from a sneeze, touching the hands, is then shared around a whole household and actually is a greater threat to causing contamination within the school system. But more importantly than that is that the newest research, I just posted it this morning on my Facebook, shows that the original, that I think it was 2 to 3 years ago, outbreak that caused a whole lot of concern came from a fully vaccinated person. And then we have to accept that measles is not a disease. Chickenpox is not a disease. These are rashes. There's a big difference. They come, you get a little fever, your skin will break out, the body's immune system kicks in, and in about 3 to 6 days, it's gone, and you're immune for life. And that's important. That's a rash. So they've been miscategorizing this as a disease. Again, these are fear mongers. They're trying to, you know what's embarrassing about all this? That the largest group of people in America who have studied the effects of vaccines and their safety and efficacy are a group of women PhDs working at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. And you never hear a word about them. But they were included in an article I wrote, one of the 52 articles that Richard Gale and I have written on vaccines. And so here's what we have. These women decided before vaccinating to look at the science because they're scientists. And they're highly educated, and they can read studies, and they did. And the vast majority chose not to vaccinate. So why don't we discuss the empowerment of the educated woman and use that as a model instead of giving no credit to mothers, educated or not, physicians or lay people, who after the fact accept the vaccines and then their children are damaged, and then they say, never again, I will not allow this to happen. I think that we're on the wrong side of this entire argument, but that's not unusual. We'll take another call.
Hi. This is a call for Gary. This is Lee in Connecticut. I'm calling about all this hysteria over the measles. I'm almost in my mid-60s, and I just got those during my grade school years, and so I have natural lifetime immunity. How do you prove that you have that? Is there a blood test or any other kind of test to confirm that? Because I don't have the records from way back then. So if you can, you know, answer that, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure. There are antibody tests that you can take, and these antibodies are lifelong. You have lifelong immunity. Whereas if you get the vaccine and 6 years later you end up getting the actual disease from which you were vaccinated or for which you were vaccinated, you get a worse and more virulent form of it. There is nothing they've been able to create, including, let's say, formula that equals the natural immune building properties of breast milk. And yet for about 20 years, the whole emphasis was upon formula, not breast milk. Now they're trying to say that natural immunity, like letting your kid play outside, letting him play in the mud, you know, let a kid be a kid. But today we have a whole group of parents that unfortunately don't know the first thing about what it is to be a parent. And so they want to do what is everyone, this collective, well, what should we do? And look at the mess that we're in today because of it. Children are weak, their immune systems are compromised. And then after they get this, vaccines, now they are autistic. And by the way, New Jersey, which has a very vigorous vaccine schedule, has a major new jump in autism cases as a percentage of the population. And as we predicted, California children are leading the nation in percentage of autism. Now, wouldn't you think at some point someone there would get that message? Gee whiz. If we go back to 1985, before the mandate to allow vaccines not to be held accountable for legally for any of the damage it does, we didn't have that many vaccines because the vaccines that were bad, the people sued and they won, so manufacturers decided it wasn't profitable. But when all you do is make a profit where you have no downside, the government actually frequently develops the vaccines for you. The CDC owns 56 or 57 patents and then gives these out to the different companies like Merck. Then Merck pays the CDC a royalty on every single vaccine. So in whose interest is it to promote vaccines? The people making money from it, both the CDC and Merck and Santa Fe and all the rest make money. But who is held liable? Well, how about nobody? As a result, there's no balance to this equation, and that's why we should be paying careful attention. Let's listen to what Dr. Suzanne Humphreys has to share on measles and shedding.
I've got another study from Croatia, and there were several cases of measles outbreaks occurring in children who had just been vaccinated. And so they looked at the strain. They're having intensive surveillance of measles during this period of time. And so they looked at, with this DNA or genetic fingerprinting, what strains they were. And it was the vaccine strain that they were infected with. So not only did they become sick from measles, from the strain that they were vaccinated with, but they were contagious. And this article, the key to this article is that it said that in the past, we would have never known this. It would have either been considered a different disease. It would have been contributed, like they would have said it was rubella or something like that. Or they would have considered that it was just a wild-type virus that the person was subsequently infected with before they had a chance to mount an immune response. But because now we have this added surveillance and this new technology that we can distinguish between strains, we're finding that these cases, we used to think that measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines didn't shed and didn't cause disease, but now we're finding that for all three of them, not only is the immune response not what we thought, but that for rubella and measles, at least for sure, I can tell you that those people are shedding virus, have the potential to shed virus and be infective.
Okay. Now, and by the way, she's done more research than any pro-vaccine person in American history. Now let's hear from another person, board-certified pediatrician, Dr. Tony Bark, B-A-R-K.
Tony Barr. I'm a licensed MD in the state of Illinois. I trained in pediatrics and rehab medicine, and I ran an emergency room, pediatric emergency room in the inner city. And during that time, I witnessed several children, after being in the vaccine clinic, coming to the emergency room in status epilepticus with asthma, even respiratory arrest. That was a while ago. Since that time, we've had an emerging field called epigenetics, which is the field of looking at the link between genetics and environmental toxins affecting people individually. Vaccines are not safe and effective for everyone. This cannot be a one-size-fits-all. Not everyone has the same risk factors. But in the last 20 to 30 years, we have elucidated some things that are known as risk factors, and they're called single nucleotide polymorphic variants. And these interface with things like drugs and vaccines very differently for different people. And this is not a one in a million type of issue. So there can be maybe up to 10 to 15% of people that are quite susceptible to different vaccines. And these are a minority, a susceptible minority, who are being left out in the rain without an umbrella. So while it sounds good and well that vaccines are safe and effective, just so you understand that they are legally classified as unavoidably unsafe, and the manufacturers are not liable. This is a liability-free product that is being mandated on children who have epigenetic susceptibility to injury. And the injuries are serious, including death and chronic encephalopathies. And while there's only been two deaths from measles in this country since 2003, there's been at least 400 and some odd children who've died from the vaccine. And according to Gregory Poland, who is a vaccinologist at Mayo Clinic, he has written an article called The Paradox of Measles, which states that you cannot eradicate a virus like measles with a live viral vaccine. You also will see that the majority of outbreaks, and while it is different in this community because you've got a tight community of unvaccinated people where this measles outbreak is happening, but the majority of measles cases around the country are actually in the vaccinated. So this is a complex picture. It's not one-sided. There's a lot of gray areas. It's very complex. The last panel would have you believe that it's not complex, that vaccines are safe and effective and the vaccine prevents measles, and that if everyone's vaccinated, there won't be measles, and that is not true. The largest outbreak that New York City has ever seen was just a few years ago, and it was started by a 22-year-old recent recipient of an MMR booster. And 35 to 40 people who had all been vaccinated got a vaccine strain measles. In Corpus Christi in 1983, there were over 400 students who had all been vaccinated, 98% vaccination rates, 97% of which had antibodies, memory antibodies, and they still got measles. This is not a clear black and white picture. And if you eliminate exemptions, we all know how difficult medical exemptions are because the requirements for medical exemptions are lagging about 30 years behind the science of the epigenetic risk factors. So if you eliminate these exemptions, you are basically making a large minority of people susceptible to very serious risks, including death.
That was Dr. Tony Bart. Keep in mind, she has spent, the last time I spoke with her, about a year ago, over 20,000 hours doing research as a medical doctor, as a scientist, as a pediatrician. And there was a time when she was very pro-vaccine. Each of the women, and there are six women, all medical doctors, all have spent thousands of hours doing research. Why hasn't the mainstream media ever called upon one of them to discuss this? You've got 100,000 hours worth of collective research. If this is not misogynist by the media, if this is not sexist by the CDC, I don't know what is. Because we keep saying empower women. Yes, give them the same opportunity without question. Only a fool would think otherwise. But then when you have highly intelligent, educated, scientific minds who have done their homework, who are scholarly and have the truth, they're the last people we call. Now, you go figure that out. It shows you how we have weaponized the arguments for Big Pharma and the government. Back in a moment with my commentary. Please stay with us. This is entitled The Race Towards Extinction, Climate Change versus 5G Rollout. To this audience by now, most of us should have come to realize that plant, animal, and human life is not eternal. There's an expiration date on everything on this planet. For several decades, atmospheric scientists have warned that the orgy of anthropogenic release of greenhouse gases, if it is permitted to continue at current rates, and it's not only being allowed to continue, in the last 12 months it increased by 3.2%. So instead of getting a handle on it, we're actually exacerbating it. The only thing we seem to have a handle on is whether we're in climate denialism or euphemisms to replace substance when it comes to supporting the environment. But this is all going to bring life as we know it to an abrupt end in the very near future. And depending upon where you live and what your occupation is, and depending upon if you're in one of the tipping areas, it could be as early as this year. Where scientists disagree and where there remains growing debate concerns the timetable before global warming's acceleration cascades into a runaway condition leading downwards to our demise. Nevertheless, one thing seems certain for anyone who bothers to follow the steady flow of climate change reports and updates. Every year, conditions are becoming more dire than the previous years, and as scientists consistently have had to reevaluate their earlier predictions, the situation is turning more drastic. Not to be outdone by the fossil fuel industry's addiction to burning fossil fuels, nor our blusterous neoliberal capitalist rush to establish full-spectrum economic dominance, the telecommunications industry in Silicon Valley are eager to enter the horse race to imperil human existence. In the past, we have regularly reported on the corruption that is endemic in our federal health agencies and the pharmaceutical industry. In the nuclear power industry, in the industry of agriculture, now we address the culture of deception that permeates the entirety of the telecommunications and wireless regime. And virtually every ad you're watching on television, which is nonstop now about the interconnectivity of all things and the speed of it and how great it is, they're all half-truths or full lies. In my opinion, it is irresponsible denialism about electromagnetic frequency radiation's effects on plant and animal life. The rollout of 5G, that means fifth generation technology across the nation, is being framed as a sprint contest against China, which is also determined to transition to 5G. Europe, in defiance of American pressures, is now leading the effort to align with Chinese company, and one in particular, Huawei, to service the European continent. It, too, is living in denialism. It is expected that within just the next 6 years, about 40% of the world's population will be connected to 5G network. That means tens of billions of devices, from cars to refrigerators, traffic lights to surveillance equipment, utility smart meters and phones will be interlinked to a global web of electromagnetic frequency technologies. Nothing with an electronic chip will be exempt. No plant or tree, insect, bird, fish, animal, or human will be able to escape 24-hour-a-day exposure to enormous, enormous amounts of electromagnetic pollution. Already, this new generation technology is being aggressively promoted and marketed to the public without any mention of its catastrophic risks. This is tantamount to what the tobacco and alcohol industries did together to get you to drink or smoke their products without any mention of the risks that they knew about. The organization Physicians for Safe Technology is now warning that its predictable adverse effects will create, quote, biological, environmental, as well as societal disruption, and be difficult or impossible to reverse. Not difficult to reverse, it will be impossible to reverse. Whereas the current 4G technology succeeded in a complete digital migration, enabling higher speeds for mobile phones and videos and internet interfaces, In the words of President Obama's FCC chair, Tom Wheeler, 5G will be, quote, Internet of everything. If something can be connected, and he said this at the National Press Club, it will be connected in the 5G world, but with predictions of hundreds of billions of microchip-enabled products, from pill bottles to plant waterers, you can be sure of only one thing. The biggest IoT, that means Internet of Things, has yet to be imagined. And he ended by saying, the 5G revolution will touch all corners, and that is damn important, end quote. The Obama administration's FCC launched the Spectrum Frontiers rules to mandate 5G rollout as a, quote, national priority. Mind you, this is President Obama and all those bright men and women around him, all of whom came from special interest groups. They were all from the swamps. And they were there to cater to what their corporate, the people, the corporate interest wanted. In the rules, we find a disturbing initiative. That is, technology will drive policy rather than vice versa. Wheeler stated that in no uncertain terms, in other words, the private telecommunications industrial complex is being given precedence over elected legislators, including congressional leaders who voice deep concerns about 5G's threats. It also has precedence over the warnings voiced by the medical, health, and environmental agencies. It would be like allowing the military-industrial complex to say, we need wars, justified or not, so we're going to dictate, with no activity of Congress to intercede or alter this, we will decide where to attack, when, and to use what, so we can continue making profits. We would say, well, that's insane. You know, you don't allow your product to be what creates policy, but that's what we've done. The 5G race actually goes back to the Bill and Hillary Clinton tag team White House. In 1996, Clinton, some will say foolishly or naively, I say completely aware of what he was doing, they handed over to the telecommunications industry carte blanche power over state and local governments to install 5G technologies. The Telecommunications Act is a dismal piece of legislation. It is another incident where Clinton was far more loyal as an enabler to private corporate interest, but not the American public. Clinton's Telecommunications Act decrees, listen carefully, that no health or environmental concern can interfere under any conditions with the telecom installations. That means that the telecommunications companies have full power to do what they want. They can put their antennas and towers anywhere, and you can't do a damn thing about it. It gives full power to the FCC to regulate telecommunications EMF's health effects, yet the FCC is not a health agency, nor are they, do they have any biomedical experts working at the FCC. In addition, the Act takes away the authority of town, city, and county councils to rule against 5G stations and cell tower installations. And if towns vote to prevent a 5G tower being erected near a school or children's park or children's hospital or crowded neighborhood, the companies have the right to sue, and they have the power and the legal precedent on their side to win in every case. For example, in the prosperous town of Moranga in the San Francisco Bay Area, town council efforts are underway as we speak to prevent the installation of 5G cell tower. The initiative is being launched by a woman whose husband, a heavy cell phone user since the mid-1980s, developed a brain tumor near the ear where he held the phone for many years. Moranga is mobilized to bring a halt to the tower. But it's a losing battle. They will lose. And there are similar cases occurring throughout the country as the public becomes increasingly warned about 5G health risks. No argument can be raised against the benefits that wireless technologies have brought to the world. Let's just be realistic. They have contributed to remarkable advances in medical diagnostic tools and security equipment, better telecommunications networks for governments, businesses, organizations, entertainment, faster connections on the World Wide Web, connected the Internet with mobile phones, and much more. Consequently, it has also been a boon for job growth, but their disadvantages and defects have been hidden from public view, and the telecommunications industry and government officials have been completely aware of these risks for over 50 years. Other risks are being identified and described as independent research and analysis outside the purview of corporate telecom oversight continues. Now, unfortunately, the government is not investing in the necessary safety studies to determine whether rolling out 5G is a wise policy. The former chairman of the FCC and the initial architect of the nation's 5G strategy has never acknowledged that there are known health risks associated with electromagnetic frequencies. He is a product of the same private industrial mindset that has churned out climate change deniers in the big oil companies and pesticide and GMO risk deniers in the big agricultural segment. Americans need to wake up to the fact that they are facing a formidable enemy in the telecommunications industry. The FCC and the cartel of telecom companies in Silicon Valley remain in complete denial about the multitude of health risks that 5G antennas, mobile phones, smart meters, and other electronic appliances that will be connected to 5G have been shown to contribute towards. Wheeler, who was appointed by Obama, took the reins of the FCC with an intention to push 5G technology regardless of any opposition. He also originally opposed net neutrality that would financially benefit Internet providers at the expense of the public. And the subsequent backlash from Silicon companies such as Google, Microsoft, and eBay forced the FCC to backpedal. There was never any question about Wheeler's loyalty to his masters in the cable and wireless industry. Before entering politics, he was a venture capitalist and a lobbyist for the telecommunications industry. He was a former president of the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, CEO of Cellular Communications and Internet Association, and the only person to twice be inducted into the Wireless Hall of Fame. What Wheeler accomplished in office on behalf of the telecommunications industry is analogous to the success of Wall Street bankers within and during the Clinton presidency to dismantle consumer protections from casino investment, like the evisceration of the Glass-Steagall Act. And since leaving the FCC, Wheeler's become a fellow at the corporate centrist Brookings Institute, where he continues to advance telecommunications commercial interest. Unfortunately, the situation has worsened under Trump. The current FCC Consumer Advisory Panel is controlled by the Koch brothers, American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, staunch opponents of net neutrality and municipal broadband and consumer protections. The agency intends to grant telecommunications industry with subsidized access to all local and state public properties. This will make the telecommunications industry's dominance over every state, city, and state council rights complete. Much of the technology that will be utilized by 5G is not completely new. The U.S. military of the Soviet Union have been experimenting with high electronic and electromagnetic frequency and microwave weaponry since the 1960s. In fact, in 1985, declassified CIA report entitled Soviet-Directed Energy Weapons reveals that the Russians have been conducting extensive research on microwave particle beams and electromagnetic frequency-directed laser weapons since the early 1960s. So their research was thorough and conceivable more advanced than the U.S. military efforts. The only practical and conceivable benefit 5G has for the average consumer is speed. That's it. Nothing more. It's anticipated to be 10 to 100 times faster than the current 4G technology, which in turn is 10 times faster than 3G. Therefore, those impatient with downloading times, it's largely only time-saving perk with greater interface capability with other wireless devices. However, it will be a far greater boon to the Defense Department's deployment and development of weapons and control of crowds With 5G circumnavigating the globe, we cannot begin to imagine the horrid possibilities of future weapons, which could even include directed measures to trigger illnesses in entire populations, in foreign populations or even our own, if that ever happened. That would be, in a way, a nightmare. A plethora of medical and environmental research has documented how much. What do we have on our side of the equation? How about this? Richard Gell and I have now come up with 10,000 peer-reviewed clinical studies mentioning serious molecular biological injury and defects to organs, neurons, cells, and cellular functions and DNA damage to plants, animals, and humans alike. And between August 2016 and September 2018, over 400 new studies on electromagnetic radiation risks have been compiled by public health professor Joe Moskowitz at the University of California, Berkeley. And these studies cover earlier generational technologies, whereas 5G will be far more evasive and less safe. In fact, they're putting this in every area with base stations every 100 meters. That's 320 feet apart. Every 328 feet in America, in cities and towns. A study published in the August issue of 2018 of Journal of Medical Imaging and Health Information concluded after an extensive review of the medical literature that, quote, incidence of cancer cases was remarkably higher among people who resided in 400 meters from mobile antennas in comparison to those who live further away. Females reported statistically more health complaints than males. Inhabitants living close to cellular antennas are also at increased risk of developing neuropsychiatric complaints, end quote. So under the 5G regime, every American in a suburb or city will be living 100 meters or less from an antenna. Your lives are screwed. It's what's called the new electric smog. And then we have attached to this over 68 separate pages of studies, so that if you wish to fight, and I hope you do, at least you will have the actual peer-reviewed literature to show how dangerous these are, the cell phones, the computers, the antennas, and all that they're doing. All developed countries which have the highest levels of electromagnetic frequency exposure and wireless device usage are witnessing a rapid decline in male fertility. That's a matter of fact. And yet we're doing nothing about any of this. So in conclusion, if we take a look at all the conditions, cardiovascular disease, 66% frequency after 5 years, circadian rhythm disruption and body temperature disruption, 85% frequency after 10 years, hypoglycemia, 59%, sensory motor disorders and chronic fatigue, 59%, depression, 66%, resting tumors and hair loss, 59% after 5 years, memory loss and chronic headaches, 50% after 5 years. That's what you're facing. And a lot of other disorders, from cancers to psychoneurodegenerative disorders. So that's what we're faced with, and they're putting 20,000 rockets into the air with 20,000 satellites, and that in itself is going to cause a tremendous carbon footprint. It is a naive experiment with potential Holocaust-like dimensions in the long term. And the preponderance of quality peer-reviewed scientific literature has established a direct link between EMF radiation emitted by mobile phones and computers and laptops and 3G to 5G antennas and towers with a multitude, unfortunately, based upon the lack of critical thinking and in-depth reporting evident in the mainstream media, it is our conclusion that we're reasonably confident this expose and the excellent articles by many others will have no impact whatsoever. Mainstream media's track record of denying scientific warnings about other human-made threats to health and life confirms our confidence. Almost nothing is being done in the United States about global warming. We are not lessening any of the precursors that cause it. The professional corporate class will do nothing if they understand climate change threats because they're just too distracted with their own life. There's simply too much profit to be made by not disrupting the status quo of conducting business as usual. And there's a national priority to push the throttle to its limit to develop worldwide wireless connectivity. Silicon Valley and its thousands of bright young minds will not wake up tomorrow and suddenly have a conscience for the first time in their worthless lives, committed to a universal set of morals and ethics. It does not exist. It will not exist. It cannot exist. Like the generations before them, they are simply chasing profits. Federal legislators have also allowed themselves to be captured by money. Federal regulatory agencies like the FCC, the USDA, EPA, FDA, CDC are fully captured by Wall Street multinational corporations. State legislators are fully captured by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and they create the bills that become laws. So we have learned no lessons from our past, but the one learned from 5G will be that we will not stop it because we have not chosen to stop any of the other enormous indiscretions against human life, the sanctity of life, and the planet, nature, species, the environment. They are all simply existential constructs that one day, if we get the time and interest, we may pay attention to. In the short term, no one's going to do anything because we never do anything and haven't done anything since the Marshall Plan and the end of World War II. I'm Gary Null. Thank you for listening.